to ensure that Tarkin had no time to make last personal arrangements with any secret cadre inside the cruiser. Suspecting as much was churlish, to be sure, but this was rapidly becoming an age of churls.
Your ship is recognized.
The voice of orbital control from Tsunami Code said,
"You have registered as an authorized client transport vessel, yet the account of your last delivered client is in doubt."
Charza Quinn drew himself up to the full height of the cabin bulkhead. Then he switched on the return link.
"This is Charza Quinn, registered owner of Star Sea Flower. I do not recall personally guaranteeing client accounts."
"No,"
the controller admitted.
"But we prefer our client transports to bring us reliable customers."
"I will return my previous client to her homeworld if she so desires, at no cost to you," Charza said innocently. "Where is she?"
There was a lengthy pause.
"That will not be necessary,"
the controller said.
"Landing permission granted. Use the northern plateau. Coordinates have not changed."
Just as they entered the upper atmosphere, Obi-Wan thought he spotted an anomalous brown desert or rift in the wide, deep green, but it quickly passed out of view. "Temperature at the landing point?" he asked.
"Last time it was above freshwater freezing," Charza said, "but only a little. The landing point is near the pole, surrounded by ice-covered seas."
"Are the seas salty?"
Anakin asked.
"I do not know," Charza said. "Anything I do up here, such as sending a laser beam down for spectrum analysis, becomes known to the planet's managers. They do not appreciate prying."
"Curious," Obi-Wan said.
"They love their secrets."
Snow was falling in large, rainbow-hued flakes outside the craft as Charza dropped the ramp. Anakin descended, with Obi-Wan a few steps behind. He saw a single figure, heavily bundled, standing away from the overhang of the ship, their lone reception.
"Welcome to Tsunami Code,"
a woman's voice said through the face filter of a snow mask. She turned before they were even close and walked toward the nearest dome. Anakin and Obi-Wan looked at each other, shrugged, and followed. Anakin was disappointed by both the reception and his first glimpse of life on Tsunami Code. What they saw entering the first dome was an empty shell, its interior so cold, their breath clouded. Obi-Wan, however, had carefully kept preconceptions from taking hold. He was open to anything, and thus found the reception and the spare quarters, if quarters they were, interesting. These people did not feel the need to impress. The woman removed her mask and shook out a thick fall of gray-white hair. Despite the color of her hair, her face was free of wrinkles. Obi-Wan would have thought her younger than he, except for the cast of wary resentment in her deep blue eyes.
"Rich, are we, and bored?" she asked curtly. "And is this your son?"
she pointed to Anakin.
"This is my student," Obi-Wan said. "I am a professional teacher. We are given funds by an organization to which we owe our education and our philosophical stance."
The woman snorted in derision.
"We do not provide ships for delivery to research groups. Go home, academics."
"We've come quite a long way," Obi-Wan said, undaunted.
"From the center of the galaxy, I know," the woman said. "That's where the credits are."
She flung her hand out at them.
"Customers. A necessary evil. I do not have to like it."
"Whatever our origins, we would hope to be treated with hospitality," Obi-Wan said calmly. He was about to try a subtle bit of Jedi persuasion when the woman's whole aspect changed. Her features softened, and she looked as if she might have suddenly seen the face of a long-lost friend. She stared over their shoulders. Anakin turned his head to look. The three of them were alone in the shelter.
"What did you do?"
he whispered to Obi-Wan.
Obi-Wan shook his head.
"Pardon me," he said to the woman. She looked down from a vague distance and focused on Obi-Wan again.
"The Magister tells me you are to go south," she said. "Your ship can remain for 4 more days." The abrupt turnaround caught Obi-Wan by surprise. She did not seem to be equipped with an ear receiver. Some other comlink was concealed in her clothing, he surmised. "This way, please," she said, and gestured for them to go through a small hatch on the opposite side of the empty dome. They found themselves again outside, in the middle of a biting, almost horizontal blast of snow. Obi-Wan looked up at a ghostly shadow descending through the storm. Though the woman showed no concern, his hand slipped automatically through his jacket to his lightsaber. What had alerted him? What stray bit of clue from the future had made him feel threatened by the expected arrival of a transport, of all things? Not for the first time, he regretted this mission and its possible impact on his Padawan. The danger he felt came from no specific source, but from all around, not a threat of physical harm, but of a possible imbalance in the Force so drastic it overshadowed anything he had ever imagined. Anakin Skywalker was not so much at risk as he was a possible cause of this imbalance. For the first time since the death of Qui-Gon Jinn, Obi-Wan felt fear, and quickly drew up the discipline instilled by long Jedi training to control and then quash it. He reached out to grip Anakin's shoulder. The boy looked up at him with a brave grin. "Your ride south," the woman announced over the wind as a broad, flat, disc-shaped transport landed in the blowing drifts of snow. Obi-Wan lifted his comlink and opened a channel with the Star Sea Flower. "We are leaving the plateau," he told Charza Quinn. "Stay here as long as they allow, and after that, maintain a position nearby." Given that Obi-Wan felt he could trust no one, flexibility was essential. It should have been among the proudest moments of Wraith Sinar's life. He had been given the rank of commander, in charge of a squadron, and yet he felt nothing but a cold, seedy dread in his viscera. But there was little time for contemplation of his precarious position. The adjutants, impatient and less than obsequious toward their new commander, had arrayed themselves on the command deck of the Admiral Corvin, and they expected dispatch. He had to give the order for coordinated entry into hyperspace. It was the final commitment he dreaded, leaving the system in which he had pooled most of his armor, most of his political cronies and contacts, and all of his wealth. Leaving home. He put on a hard face and found that the expression was comfortable and not entirely false. "Are the squadron corps in synchrony, Captain?" "They are, Commander," Ket responded. "Then let's blow the stardust off our tails," Sinar said, hoping that the language was not too antiquated. He stared through the Admiral Corvin's forward ports, hands gripping the railing of his command pulpit, as the order was carried through to the Link Squadron droid navigation system. The forward view skewed and fanned outward, then drew into a brilliant point. "We are entering hyperspace, Commander," Ket murmured. "Estimated journey time, 3 standard days. "Let's use that time to do more drills on defensive systems," Sinar said. That would serve as a good distraction for the flagship crew while he did other tasks. "And present me with the service records of every command officer in the squadron. The complete records, Captain Ket." That sounded better. "I'll prepare a plan and submit the records within the hour, sir," Ket said. Much better. It felt right. A good beginning to a complicated mission. Anakin squirmed on the cramped transport, unable to see through the small ports placed inconveniently behind the seats. The transport offered only the most basic comfort, 4 seats, narrow and slung beneath a low ceiling, and a closed cabin door between them and the pilot. Obi-Wan could sense a human behind the door, and nothing more. "This is no way to run a planet," Anakin said. Obi-Wan agreed. "They behave as if they have recently suffered problems." "With Verger?" Obi-Wan smiled. Verger was given no instructions to disrupt, perhaps with the unknown visitors she was sent to investigate. "I don't feel anything like that around here," Anakin said. I can feel the force in this entire planet and in the settlers, but...
He grimaced and shook his head.
Obi-Wan knew that Anakin was often more tuned than he to small variations in the force.
What do you sense?
Something large. Not a lot of little curls or waves, but one big wave. A really big change that's already happened or is coming. I don't know how else to describe it.
The transport landed with a shudder an hour later, and the ramp instantly swung down with a harsh squeal. Warm, thick air flowed into the cabin, scented with something at once floral and rich. As they bent low to climb out of the craft, they found themselves on a broad platform suspended between four huge dark trunks, each over a dozen meters in diameter. Overhead, bright sun filtered through rank upon rank of layered foliage, many meshed canopies of growth that shaded their surroundings and made it seem as if they walked in deep twilight. They both straightened and faced a tall, strong-looking human male in long black robes decorated with brilliant green medallions. He stood well over 2 meters in height, much taller than Obi-Wan, and his face was pale and blue as Tatooine milk.
"You're on Zonama Sikot," he said, "a planet of considerable beauty and firm tradition. My name is Gan."
"A pleasure to meet you," Obi-Wan said as he and Anakin approached the tall man. Judging by his color and bearing, he was native to one of the inner Pharaoh systems, reclusive and not always compliant with the laws of the Republic. Pharaohans were proud and independent peoples who seldom welcomed outsiders and almost never traveled far from home.
"Where are your ships, the really fast ones?" Anakin asked, bored by this adult show, his enthusiasm getting the better of him.
"This is my student, Anakin Skywalker of Tatooine," Obi-Wan introduced. "I am Obi-Wan Kenobi." Gan looked down on Anakin, and his expression softened.
"I, too, have a son," he said. "A special student. Many sons and daughters. That is what we call our students here. I'm afraid you will not see one of our ships for some days, young Anakin."
He returned his attention to Obi-Wan and swung out his arm.
"We are at what we call the Middle Distance, our first home on Zonama Sikot, where we settled 20 Pharaoan years ago, 60 standard years. Not that time means the same here as on any of the Pharaoan worlds, or on Coruscant."
"Our accents give us away?" Obi-Wan asked.
"Even a few months on the capital world imparts a way of speaking that is distinctive," Gan said.
"We wish to enter into a contract and purchase a ship," Obi-Wan said. "We have the credits, and we are ready to engage in the tests and the training."
Gan drew up his thin black eyebrows. "Ritual first, answers and tests much later."
Then turning, he said,
"The view from here is not the best. Come with me, I need to introduce you to Sikot."
Obi-Wan and Anakin followed Gan to a gap between two of the huge trunks that enclosed and supported the platform. Master and apprentice stepped out onto an exterior platform bathed in sunlight and overlooking a scene even more spectacular than Charza Quinn had shown them aboard the Starsea Flower. Gan folded his arms and smiled proudly. Morning mists were rising from a wandering river valley fully 2 kilometers below the platform. Along the upper walls of the valley, tier upon tier of dwellings and platforms covered the bare rock face, held in place by great brown and green vines. The vines hung from great-rooted boras, straddling knife-sharp ridges, topped with more brilliant purple and green canopies. Several airships navigated the calm morning currents between the ridges. These were made up of clusters of rigid, tube-shaped, bone-white balloons strapped side by side. The airships followed lengths of cable strung across the valley, supported at 100-meter intervals by trunks thrust up from the sides. Even now, an airship was threading its way through the circular crown of foliage at the top of a support.
"The planet is named Zonama," Gan said. "The living world that covers it is named Sikot. This is a small part of Sikot, as are the Boras around and behind us, and, we believe, as are we who live here. To be worthy to fly a piece of Sikot, one of our ships, you must tune yourself to our way. You must acknowledge the Magister and his role in our life and history, and you must acknowledge union with Sikot. It's not an easy course, and there are real dangers. The power of Sikot is awesome. Do you accept? Obi-Wan's expression did not change. We accept. Follow me, please, and I will show you where you will stay.
Why don't you just go and ask about Vergaer?
Anakin said to Obi-Wan as they settled into their rooms in the clients' quarters of Middle Distance.
I get the impression we must be patient, Obi-Wan answered as he opened a pair of shutters and looked down over the valley. The airship ride to the training district had been routine enough, but still beautiful, and to Anakin, very exciting. All of his odd sensations and premonitions had faded in the glory of bright sun and open air, rare enough on Coruscant, impossible aboard the Star Seaflower.
It's different here, Anakin said. Not like Tatooine, but I still feel at home.
Yes, Obi-Wan said ruefully. So do I, and that concerns me. The air is rich with many substances. Perhaps some of them affect humans.
It smells great,
Anakin said, leaning out the window and staring down into the shadows at the river coursing far below.
It smells alive.
What else do you sense? Obi-Wan asked, the very question Anakin had hoped to avoid. He made a sour face.
I don't want to sense anything now. I just want to enjoy the daylight and the air. Charles's ship was wet and cramped, and I've never liked space travel. It always feels cold to me out there in the middle of nowhere. I prefer being in the middle of living things.
Anakin looked up at Obi-Wan.
I'm yakking my head off, aren't I?
Obi-Wan grinned and touched Anakin's shoulder.
Cheer is a useful emotion at times, if it does not mask carelessness. Obi-Wan thought of Qui-Gon and of Mace Windu. He had seen both of them almost ebullient, even in difficult situations requiring deep concentration. A talent he had not yet mastered.
Are you ever cheerful, Master?
Anakin asked.
I will have time to be cheerful when you tell me what you sense. I need a baseline against which I can measure my own perceptions.
Anakin sighed and pulled up a tall stool with four slender legs. His fingers felt the dark green substance of the furniture, and he suddenly let go of it, letting it thump to the floor.
It's still alive, he said in wonder,
then bent to set it upright again.
They call their building material lamina, Obi-Wan said. It is not necessary to kill to make their homes and furniture. All the furniture is still alive, and the dwelling itself. Extend your feelings for a moment and see what is there.
Right, Anakin said, but almost immediately his mind wandered back to the curiosity of the moment. How does it stay alive, this lamina? What does it eat? How does it...
Padawan, Obi-Wan said, without a hint of sternness, but in a distinct tone that Anakin had long since come to recognize and instantly react to.
Yes...
The boy pushed the stool aside and stood still in the middle of the room. He became intensely outward alert. A few minutes passed.
It's an immensity. A unity, Anakin said finally. Not a lot of little voices.
The life forms here are all naturally symbiotic, Obi-Wan agreed. Not the usual pattern of competition and predation. It's part of what you felt before, the sense of one fate, one destiny.
Anakin thought this over with a frown.
I can feel the newcomers, the colonists, separately, he said. I don't sense Vergaer anywhere.
She has gone, Obi-Wan agreed.
So let's go ask where she went.
In good time, Obi-Wan lifted his eyes.
Observe your stool.
Anakin looked down and saw that one foot had fastened to the floor. He bent and touched the connection, then looked up in wonder at Obi-Wan.
It's feeding, he said. The floor is alive, too. The boy's emotional energy level was still too high for Obi-Wan's comfort. There was an interaction between Anakin and Sikote he could not yet understand, and what puzzled him was that this revealed as much about Anakin as it did about Sikote, and also revealed that Obi-Wan still knew very little about either. It was the first day of client celebration that had been held for some time at Middle Distance, and the air was filled with many-colored balloon ships flying back and forth along their cables, loaded with officials, workers, and the curious. Anakin and Obi-Wan stood by the rail of the gondola of the large airship that carried them down the length of the valley. The oblong gondola featured a small cabin and a long, curved roof made of sheets of lamina and thickly woven tendrils, all still alive. Gam accompanied them on this trip. About midway down the canyon, he stepped forward to the prow to confer with a tall Faroan woman. Wind carried snatches of string instruments and song from other airships. Obi-Wan listened to the musicians and singers with wonder. These ceremonies were important, but something else was in the air, a sense of renewal after a long ordeal. He wondered whether Bergair had witnessed that ordeal. Had she left any messages for the Jedi who would follow? If so, Obi-Wan had not found them. 10 minutes before we arrive, Gam said. You have all that is necessary? Obi-Wan looked to Anakin, who winked and patted his tunic, under which the packet of old-style Erodium credits was concealed. Yes, Obi-Wan answered. But I'd be much more comfortable if we were more familiar with the procedures. Gam nodded. I'm sure you would, he said. Everybody would. There is only one client this day, counting you and the boy as a part in a team. So you are alone in your time of choosing. Any more than that would be telling. The other passengers on the airship were Faroans as well, with pale blue and ghostly white skins, long jaws, and wide eyes. The female that Gan had been conversing with was larger and somewhat more heavily muscled than the males. She walked around the cabin as they approached the high, vine-suspended landing and introduced herself. I am Shikla Farz, she said, her voice strong and deep. I am a grower and daughter of firsts. Gan gives you to me now for the rest of this day. Anakin looked up. Are we going to see the ships now? When Farz laughed, her deep voice became high and quite musical. Today, you meet your seed partners. When that is done, you design your ship. The pilot unhooked the airship from its cable, then deftly strung it onto a secondary cable leading to the landing. A ramp was dropped, and Shikla Farz indicated they should cross ahead of her. We are now at far distance, Shikla Farz said. This is where we gather our seed partners and the prospective clients. There is a ceremony, of course. She smiled at Anakin. Very formal. You'll hate it. Anakin wrinkled his nose. But you'll be meeting what could become your ship, she added. Anakin brightened. And you'll undergo what the Magister experienced so many years ago when he alone saw Zonama and knew Sikote for the first time. Who's the Magister? Anakin asked. Shikla Farz gave Obi-Wan a glance then that he could not read, though it seemed to mingle both respect and warning. He is our leader, our spiritual advisor, and the knower. His father was founder of Middle Distance and the pioneer for all we do here. Gam made his farewells, promising to meet with them later, and Farz led them across the bridge that connected the landing to a broad tunnel dug directly into the rock wall. The seed partners emerge from a potentium, Farz told them as they reached the end of the tunnel. Surprised by that word, potentium, Obi-Wan reached back far into his memory to conversations with Qui-Gon Jinn before the Jedi Master had taken him on as a Padawan. Farz pushed through a door and took them into a broad courtyard open to the sky. The trunks of smaller boras leaned over the courtyard on three sides. On the fourth side, a neatly paved stone floor ended abruptly at an abyss. They heard the sound of the river beyond, apparently rushing into a subterranean cavern. "If you fail, they will return to the Potentium," Fars continued. "All is conserved. The seed partners are very important here."
"I don't know that word," Anakin said to Obi-Wan. "What's a Potentium?"
The branch of Jedi training that had embraced Potentium had long since been judged by the Council to be in error and abandoned. It was no longer even mentioned to Padawans. Obi-Wan recalled that Qui-Gon and Mace Windu had once dealt with a group of acolytes who had shown promise, but had not been accepted into Jedi training. In disappointment and anger, one of them had tried to start his own version of the Jedi, enlisting students from aristocratic families on Coruscant and Alderaan. Qui-Gon had mentioned Potentium, a controversial variety of force perception at which this apprentice had excelled, though he had failed in other regards.
"I'll be curious to discover the meaning myself," Obi-Wan said, "and how and why it is being used here."
The courtyard was filled with a brightly dressed crowd of celebrants, standing in clusters of five and six throughout, all silent. Anakin and Obi-Wan advanced slowly at the urging of Sheikh Lafarz. A low woman's voice began singing, the same song they had heard coming from the other airships. In Faroans, maturity darkened the hair of males, but not females. Two older men with jet-black hair stepped forward carrying sashes hung with blood-red gourd-like fruits. The taller of the two slung a sash around Obi-Wan's neck, and the other slipped his over Anakin's head. Now all joined in the song, and the chorus of voices echoed from the courtyard's stone walls. Fars smiled broadly. "They approve. They like the way you look and smell. You aren't afraid." The taller man walked in a circle, thrusting his chin at three points of the Zanama compass, then turned back to Obi-Wan and held out his hands. "Your offering to the Potentium," Fars suggested. At a gesture from Obi-Wan, Anakin slipped his hand through his loose tunic and drew out the pouched belt containing the bars of Old Republic or Rhodium. He passed it to Obi-Wan, who passed it in turn to the Elder, who accepted it with a smile and a slight bow. "Now we introduce you to Sikot," Far said, rewarding them with a beaming and most unmercenary smile. "I am so very, very optimistic." The lengthy journey through hyperspace was beginning to wear on Wraith Sinar. There had been three inspections so far of the Admiral Corvin and the holds that carried the greater part of their armament. However much Sinar tried to muster enthusiasm for the weapons at his command, he could not stop that intellectual itch that told him he was being set up. He just could not figure out why he was being set up. Who would benefit from the failure of this mission? The time was approaching when he would have to meet with his appointed assistant, the blood carver Ki Daive. Ki Daive gave him the creeps, but at least he seemed intelligent and, despite his failure against the Jedi, competent enough. That meeting would require some preparation. Sinar pulled a small box from his luggage case and examined it in a bright light that descended from the ceiling at the touch of a button. Next, a small table and set of tools rose from the floor. His fingers were less than steady, but the work of preparing the box was not exceptionally delicate. Inside was a custom droid verbobrain of his own design, carrying his own programs. He fingered a communications button and an image of Captain Kett flickered to life before him. "Send a Bactoid Model E-5, fully operational and fully armed, to my quarters." Bactoid Combat Automata had designed and manufactured these heavy, unwieldy droids as Trade Federation replacements after Naboo. They were, in Sinar's opinion, the best of a mediocre lot, their greatest weakness being their lack of intelligence. Their verbo brains were as slow as any tanks. He opened the box, removed the verbrain, and inserted a new programming cylinder into a vacant slot. The spinner within the unit began to whir and to seek data from its radiance of inputs. With this, Sino believed he could make an E5 dance like a female Twi'lek. And with the modified E5 a fixture in his quarters, he would meet with Key Dive and tell him a thing or two about the people, the humans, he was working for. The crowd had parted in silence to let Obi-Wan and Anakin through. Sheik Lafarge held back and watched them approach the massive stone and laminar door, which swung open. Beyond lay a great open spherical chamber, like the inside of a ball with its top sectioned away. Late morning sun moved in a brilliant oblong across the rear of the chamber, which crawled with thousands of living things, spike-covered balls a little smaller than a human head. Anakin looked upon the thousands of thorny spheroids with a smile, for he knew intuitively that they were the seed partners.
"These will grow to become our ship," he whispered to Obi-Wan.
Anakin ran ahead, and Obi-Wan broke into a trot to keep up. The boy held out his arms, as if in welcome. Except for a morning breeze lazing down from the opening to the sky, silence filled the room. The door behind them closed noiselessly. They were alone with the seed partners.
"What are you waiting for?"
the boy shouted. "We should let them take the initiative," Obi-Wan advised softly. Anakin scowled impatiently. Suddenly he was a 12-year-old boy, nothing more. He showed nothing of his 3 years of training in the temple. The dropping away from his Padawan of every aspect of Obi-Wan's teaching dismayed the Jedi for a moment. It was as if he stood behind a totally different child than the one Qui-Gon had thought was so special. Anakin spoke, his words barely audible, then louder. "I'm ready." Only now did Obi-Wan catch on, and the hair on his neck bristled in a way it had not for years, not since he had encountered and defeated, though just barely, the strange red and black Sith, Darth Maul, the Sith who had mortally wounded Qui-Gon. The boy had totally damped all extraneous personal vibrations. He had become quiet in the Force, in a way Obi-Wan still found exceptionally difficult. And the boy had done this in fractions of a second. Anakin had made himself into a quiet antenna, listening to the creatures within the sphere. He had accomplished this with the swift and native genius of a child, not the disciplined and learned ability of an adult. And the spike balls, equally quiet, were listening to both of these potential clients with all the openness of a different variety of childhood. Two of the bristling spheres disengaged midway up the wall of the chamber and clambered down their companions until they came to the clearing on the bowl of the floor, the empty space surrounding the two humans. The spike balls rolled slowly now in a wavering path until they were just centimeters from the boy's feet. More spike balls disengaged and followed. In a few moments, Anakin and Obi-Wan were surrounded by 10 of the milling seed partners, each making small clicking noises and producing a rich, flowery smell. "They approve," Anakin said, glancing at his master. Within the boy's eyes, enthusiasm had been tempered by a new caution. "But if they approve, it means a real commitment, doesn't it?"
"I presume," Obi-Wan said.
The spike balls began to vibrate on the floor. Obi-Wan looked up to the rim of the chamber wall and saw many more spike balls descending. The purposeful descent quickly turned into frenzied dropping. The carpet of seed partners began to unravel as dozens, then hundreds of the thorny spheres broke free and fell to collide with their companions in the lower part of the bowl.
"They're all going to fall!" Anakin shouted. He turned, but there was nowhere to run. He stood straight and reached for Obi-Wan. "This is going to be bad, but whatever you do, don't be afraid."
Obi-Wan instinctively reached for his lightsaber, but that would have been useless. All they could do was stand back to back and cover their faces as every spike ball in the chamber poured down onto the floor in a thorny cascade. In seconds, Anakin and Obi-Wan were awash in the deluge, bumped and battered mercilessly. They pushed out with their hands to keep their faces clear, but the torrent pressed from all sides, rising over their heads and slamming the backs of their hands against their lips and noses. Fragments of spikeball and shed shells flew into the air, and a cloud of dust rose from the churning heap. They could not move. In seconds, they could not even breathe. "I have great respect for the culture of the Blood Carvers," Wraith Sinar told the tall, almost silent figure that stood in the anteroom to the commander's quarters. He could hear Ki Daiv's slow, soft breathing. "Why did you bring me here?" Ki Daiv asked after a moment. "Please, come in and make yourself comfortable." Wraith stood back and gestured toward the sitting room. Ki Daiv gently bent his triple joints and knelt, rather than sit on the divan. "I admire your people, and I hope we can exchange information useful to both of us," Sinar said. Ki Daiv turned his head slowly, and his face formed a disconcerting blade shape as his wide nose flaps came together. He turned to look at the E5 droid hulking in one corner. The droid rotated its wide, flat head in their direction, jewel-red eyes glowing like coals, and adjusted its stance to face the Blood Carver directly. "Do you believe all that you've been told about this mission?" Sinar said. Ki Daiv turned one eye toward him, but kept the other on the E5. "I have been told little. I know that you do not trust me."
"We're equal in that regard," Sinar said.
"And in no other. I am still commander. I am your leader."
"Why remind me if you are so certain?"
Ki Daiv asked bluntly. Sinar smiled and held out his hands in admiration.
"Perhaps we are equal in other ways. You have doubts, and I have doubts. You know little or nothing about me, or what I hold in reserve."
Ki Daiv's joints cracked softly, and he turned away from the E5. The droid did not frighten him.
"What do you wish to know?"
"I understand you have a contract with Tarkin."
"You cannot understand what you do not know, and you cannot know this."
"A little respect," Sinar suggested in a soft rumble.
"Commander,"
Ki Daiv added, with another soft cracking of his arm joints,
"your contract with Tarkin is all you can obtain, because you failed to kill a Jedi."
"Two Jedi," Ki Daiv corrected.
"An understandable failure, but still a disgrace to your superiors and, I presume, your clan. Do you hope to make up for this disgrace by succeeding in this mission?"
"I always hope for success."
Sinar nodded. "Killing Jedi is a mug's game, Ki Daiv. They are strong, and they have honor, and they respect all peoples and their ways. Why would you want to kill them?"
"I have no honor in my family, and that is all I may say," Ki Daiv told him.
"I did some research before we left and discovered in the Blood Carver genealogical registry on Coruscant that you are listed as extended, which means, I believe, a kind of extreme probation. Is this true?"
"It is true."
"Tell me how this happened. That is an order."
"I am constrained," Ki Daiv said.
"If you disobey my order, I can have you executed. Under the Trade Federation rules, these officers still believe in and follow. That would remove you from any chance of redeeming yourself, and put you on the list of permanent exclusion from the art beyond dying. That is the finale of life within the Blood Carver belief system, a glorious conception of the afterlife with which I, personally, would hate to interfere. But I ask you to listen closely to what I have to tell you."
Ki Daiv lifted his head and brought his nose wings submissively back against his cheeks.
"You followed your quarry to the bottom of the Wicker Refuse Pit, and remarkably, you survived the garbage worms there. You climbed back against all the odds and reported your failure. That is bravery befitting any clan warrior, and a commitment to duty beyond anything I've heard about on Coruscant for decades. Yet there is a rumor going around that..."
Sinar hesitated for effect and shook his head incredulously.
There is a rumor going around that in the future of the Republic, there may be no room for your people. No room for any species but humans. I will not support such a scheme. Will you?
He Dive glared at Wraith Sinar.
This is true.
It is what I have been told by an old friend and classmate who seems to know.
Tarkin?
Sinar nodded, and using his most persuasive voice, trained by years of speaking with armament and ship agents and fleet buyers, said,
Examine your memory of Tarkin and disagree with me if you must.
Ki Daiv closed his eyes, opened them, said nothing.
Let us talk some more, Sinar said, and see if there are plans on which we can agree.
Sinar, of course, did most of the talking.
The great stone and laminar doors swung open again. The crowd had pulled back to the periphery of the great room, leaving only Sheik Lafarz near the door. She was now joined by Gam. They peered curiously into the big round chamber. The spike balls, once more covering the walls, were as still as the stone to which they clung. At the bottom of the bowl, a slight descent from the big doors, a pile of debris rose 2 meters from the floor. Farz called out 2 names. Obi-Wan Kenobi got to his feet first and touched himself with quick gestures. 3 spike balls clung to him, 1 on each arm, and 1 on his chest. Their grip was tenacious, and he did not try to dislodge them much as he wanted to. He looked around the pile of shed spikes and shells, the detritus of the terrifying cascade, and saw an arm poking out from the thickest portion. He grabbed Anakin's hand and pulled him up. Anakin was cluttered with spike balls from head to foot, 12 of them. His pulse was strong, but he had gone inward to conserve oxygen and avoid the shock that might come with physical injury, and his eyes were closed.
"Great skies!" Farz cried. "Is he all right? We've never seen such a..."
Gan ran down the dip to the bottom of the chamber and helped Obi-Wan carry the encumbered and unwieldy boy through the doors. They laid him out on a cushion brought out by 2 young female attendants. All were careful not to dislodge the seed partners. Seeing the clients, the crowd let out a breath, some muttering little strings of words as if in prayer.
Great is the Potentium, great the life of Sikot. All serve and are served, and all join the Potentium.
Obi-Wan held his anger and concern in tight check.
Did you know this would happen? He asked Sheik Lafarz.
Her face was heavy with dismay.
No. Is he alive?
He's alive. He reached down to touch the spike ball on his chest. It had pushed a spike through his tunic and coat to reach the skin beneath, but he felt no wound there, merely an uncomfortable adhesion.
Do they take sustenance from us?
No, Gan said, kneeling beside Anakin. They don't suck your blood.
So many. The most partners we've ever seen on a client.
3 is normal, Farz interrupted. You have the normal number. Your student must be an extraordinary young man.
Anakin's eyes fluttered, then opened, and the boy stared up at Obi-Wan from the depths of an utter calm.
You're not injured, Obi-Wan told him.
I know, Anakin said.
They're friendly. So many wanted to join us all at once.
Farz told the attendants to carry the boy into the post-partnering room. The 2 females, little older than Anakin, helped him to his feet while avoiding pushing against the spike balls, and the group walked toward a narrow door near a corner.
I need to verify something, Farz murmured. She guided them toward a low table illuminated by a broad lamp.
Farz and Gan took brass and steel instruments from a cupboard and measured Anakin's spike balls first, then
pinched the clinging spikes until they let go with small sighs. Each spike ball was placed in a lamina box, and the attendants labeled the boxes with a circle. They then removed Obi-Wan's seed partners and placed them in boxes they marked with a square.
"There will be a ship, a very dense and marvelous ship," Farz murmured as she checked her measurements against a chart mounted on one end of the table. She conferred in whispers with Gan for a moment.
"Three of these seed partners have chosen a client before," Farz said when they stopped their whispering. "One of them chose you, Obi-Wan, this time. Two chose you, Anakin."
"Who did they belong to before?" Obi-Wan asked. "We do not reveal the names of our clients," Gan said.
"That is right," Farz said. "We did not want to deceive, but—"
"This client did not stay with us long enough to grow a ship," Gan said, and exchanged another look with Farz. "The seed partners returned to the Potentium."
"Pardon us," Sheikh Lafarz said. "We need to confer again in private, so we will leave you here for a few minutes. Please rest, relax. The attendants will bring food and drink."
"All right,"
Anakin said, lifting his arms and resting his hands beneath his head.
The boy grinned broadly. "I see you're amused," Obi-Wan said.
"I'm glad to be alive," Anakin explained. "And I got more than you," he added. "More even than Vergaer."
Obi-Wan pressed his finger to Anakin's lips. "We do not know the other was her."
"It had to be," Anakin said. "Who else?"
Obi-Wan let this pass. He suspected the boy was right.
"At any rate, how do we know more is better?" he cautioned.
"It always is," Anakin said.
After 10 minutes, Gan returned alone. Anakin's face fell on seeing the Faroan's dour expression.
"There's a difficulty," Gan told them. "The Magister thinks we should not proceed to the designing and forging the next steps until he meets with you."
"Is that good or bad?" Anakin asked. "Do we get to make the ship?"
"I don't know," Gan said. "He rarely meets with anybody."
He peered at them from under thick and merged brows.
"We will keep your seed partners ready, and when you return, if all is well, we will begin the design and the conversion, and proceed to the annealing and the shaping."
Captain Kett greeted the commander with civility as he mounted the navigation deck of the Admiral Corvin.
"We are nearing emergence," he told Sinar.
Sinar nodded abstractedly.
"How good are the ship's duplication facilities, Captain Kett?"
"Our astromech complement is adequate to conduct many major repairs in transit, and nearly all minor ones," Kett reported.
The E-5 was doing quite well with its new capabilities, and the Blood Carver was reacting favorably to his new perspective. So far so good, but there was so much farther to go.
Sinar held out a small box of data cards.
"I would like to have these programs loaded into the ship's manufactory and placed in all the battle droids. The programming will be duplicated from these data cards and activated in each unit to replace all previous programming."
"All, Captain Kett."
"And, of course, I will perform authentication tests."
Kett's polite expression froze.
"That is not authorized, sir. It's against Trade Federation policy."
"I have my own instructions from Tarkin himself, and they are explicit," Sinar said calmly.
The Bactoid E-5 droid strode onto the bridge of the flagship. No threat was implied, merely a demonstration of the new way of things as far as droids were concerned. Normally, this droid would not have been activated until battle. Kett watched the machine with obvious misgivings.
"Understood, sir."
"Reversion,"
the hyperdrive control officer announced.
"About time," Sinar said with a sigh.
Sinar would have reveled in any normal pattern of stars whatsoever, but what he saw now was impressive, very impressive. The outward spiraling ribbon of the red giant and white dwarf components filled his eyes with a dreamlike, fiery light. In any other part of the Republic, this system would have attracted millions of rich tourists, but hidden as it was, very likely its witnesses had thus far numbered in the thousands. Seeing such a sight was a rare privilege. With some assurance of subtlety and Sinar-bred creativity in his weapon systems, Sinar could actually enjoy the view. The Sikotan air transport dodged with dizzying speed over tall, thick-trunked boras. Their bloated, balloon-like leaves spun and wobbled in the wind of the passage. "I think the settlers used those leaves to make their airships," Anakin said. Obi-Wan nodded, lost in thought. Only organisms strong in the Force could detect Jedi. It was becoming more and more apparent that the life forms of this world, Sikot as Gan called the living totality, were special, and that his Padawan strongly attracted them. "This is really beautiful," Anakin said. "The air smells great, and the jungle is wizard. Remember your earlier feelings about Sikot?"
"I do,"
Anakin said. "You mentioned a single wave, something happening now or in the future."
"Yeah,"
Anakin said. He nodded his head forward to the door that hid the pilot from them. Obi-Wan held up his hand. "He is oblivious to our talk.
It's important we analyze what's happening before we get drawn in further. I feel it myself now. Something coming toward us rapidly, something dangerous."
Anakin shook his head sadly. "I hope nothing happens before we get our ship made." Obi-Wan narrowed his eyes in disapproval. "I am concerned you are losing your perspective." The journey continued for another hour. Anakin looked east and pointed out a huge brown scar on the landscape stretching over the horizon. Obi-Wan had seen this briefly from space, but Charza Quinn had brought them down before completing a full orbit of Zonama Sikot. The scar had dug clear through to bedrock. Iron-rich, red crust opened like the edges of a wound over dark, tumbled chunks of basalt.
"What made that?" Anakin asked.
"It looks no more than a few months old," Obi-Wan said. "It resembles a battle scar." Anakin turned in his seat.
"Look," he said excitedly and pointed to their right.
They were veering southwest toward a jagged reddish-black mountain that pushed up through the clouds, its leveled summit capped with snow. It looked like an old, weather-worn volcano. "We will be at the Magister's home in 3 minutes," the pilot said. Obi-Wan and Anakin crouched low to exit the transport and stood on a level field of crushed lava. A few meters away, a flat stone pathway pointed to a magnificent fortress-like palace of skewed blocks stacked around a squat central tower. Beyond the palace, four volcanic terraces spilled orange-tinted water over broad, multicolored falls. The air smelled of Zonama's depths, hydrogen sulfide, alternating with fresh breezes blowing from the south. Anakin gave a small shiver. The boy looked up at the glowing pinwheel of plasma unwinding from the distant double star system.